Hello, I'm Alex Smith. Today we're going to challenge your thinking and maybe even your way of life. My guest is Derek Jensen, a prolific environmental writer, speaker, and advocate for nature. To some, he is the bad boy of the green movement, and to many more, a guiding light. Derek, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, I have some difficult questions, the kind that we all face, and I'm hoping you're going to be able to help me out a little bit, as maybe we can work through them together. Here is one. I've just heard a speech by Joel Covell on eco-socialism, and he seems to offer a new version of Marxism where the revolution no longer depends upon the working class, and I'm perplexed. What do you think about a marriage of environmentalism to this Marxist-style socialism?
Well, I can't comment specifically on him because I don't know his work. But in general, the problem isn't merely capitalism, which of course is one of the problems. Part of the problem is industrialism. I mean, it doesn't matter whether the workers are, whether the factories are controlled by, Bill Gates or Dick Cheney or the horny-handed workers. You know, it still ends up requiring inputs. I mean, if you have a pulp mill that's owned by the workers, you still have, you're still going to be pulping forests. And it still costs you more than $1 billion, which means that for it to be economical, it needs to run 24 hours a day, which means it needs to consume forests everywhere. And so the problems, once again, I mean, I don't know his particular perspective, but I know Marxism in general, if it doesn't question industrialism, it's just a continuation of the same old anthropocentrism.
Well, I agree, and I think you've cut right to the point on that one. Well, looking at your own work, I know you have a book out titled Thought to Exist in the Wild, Awakening from the Nightmare of Zoos. Why zoos and why now?
I'm sorry to say that the actual reason for that book is pretty prosaic, which is that years ago, I became acquainted with Karen Tweedy Holmes and her work. She's a photographer in that book, and I loved the work so much that I wanted to do a book with her. And so it wasn't, because she had the photographs of zoos, that pretty much determined the subject. And so that, once again, is not a very exciting reason, but of course zoos are just horrid, horrid things, and I was really glad once I got into it to be able to do my best for, as a writer, for the incarcerated animals. If you want, we can talk about the, what are some of the conclusions there, or we can go a different direction, whatever you'd like to do.
Well, I'd just like to remark that sometimes, I've lived out in the bush myself, even without electricity for many years, and now when I walk by a concrete apartment block and I look up and I see people moving about in their boxes, I think about zoos. I mean, aren't we also captured animals?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And that's one of the points that I make in there that I was pretty pleased with, was that zoos... zoos teach terrible things about so-called habitat by taking animals out of their context. You know, if you take a wolverine out of its area, you still have a wolverine, and that's just nonsense. I mean, a wolverine is part of its surroundings. I mean, that's what makes the wolverine, and that's what makes the surroundings. And anyway, so they've gone away from bars and toward glass and moats and everything, and the reason is because it's less obvious it's a cage. And the same is true for us. As we get more and more metabolized into the system, we need less and less of, we need fewer and fewer bars, and, we can have our quote habitat instead of real habitat.
Well, the way it is now, I mean, you can live a great deal of your life and not know whether the moon is out or what phase it's in.
Well, that's a big part of, that's a huge part of the problem, too, is that, and that's, John A. Livingston wrote this great book called The Fallacy of Wildlife Conservation. One of the things he talked about in there that was very important to my understanding was that a lot of times when people go to cities, he says, well, they are, people will say that I went to the city and I was overwhelmed by all the sounds. And so they think it's like sensory overload. And John A. Livingston made the point that it's not actually sensory overload, it's sensory deprivation in a sense, because everything is that surrounds you is of human origin or is mediated by humans. Like right now, I mean, I live out in the country, but I'm inside right now, and so, you know, I see, you know, the paint and plaster on the walls. I see photographs of human beings. I see a needlepoint thing of a wolf, but it was done by my mom. And I look out through the window, and through this little itty-bitty space, you know, I can see some wild. And I think about this, you know, how many machines are within, you know, 10 feet of you right now, or 20 feet, and how many wild animals are within 50 feet? And how many machines do you have a daily relationship with versus how many wild animals do you have or plants do you have a daily relationship with? And one of the reasons this is really important is because, as, I mean, John A. Livingston makes clear that when you are in an echo chamber, when you're surrounded only by sounds of your own origin, essentially, you go insane. And he says, and I agree with this, that most of our ideologies are, and I don't know if he says most, but our ideologies are hallucinations. I mean, all this attention to the stock market as the world is destroyed. I mean, if all you see around you is your own making, then it makes more sense that you're going to become really, really, really narcissistic because nothing else exists and from your perspective. And we see this, for example, in all of the so-called solutions that are presented to global warming. It's pretty stunning because they all take the economic system as a given and the natural world as a dependent variable, as something that can, you know, basically we can take it or leave it. And that's all wrong. I mean, that's an inverse of physical reality. The real story is that physical reality is primary, and whatever economic system is layered over the top of it is secondary. And it's a measure of our insanity and stupidity that there's all these solutions that are all predicated on attempting to maintain this way of life that's so clearly killing the planet. That's just stunning. And I did an interview down, it was horrible. It was like, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago. And the interviewer was out of Santa Barbara, California. And he was terrible. He's this right-wing, anti-environmental Bible thumper. And I guess he just wanted an environmentalist to yell at for a while. And as we're talking, I was saying things like, you know, 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone, or, you know, 6 to 10 times as much plastic as there is phytoplankton in the oceans. There's dachs in every mother's breast milk, you know, all the stuff we all know. And he kept saying, Derek, let's get back to the real world. And what the real world was for him was industrial capitalism. And it's just like when people are in college, a lot of times they'll say, you know, what are you going to do when you get out in the real world? And what they really mean is, what do you do when you go into the job market? That's not the real world. The real world is this, you know, that tree right there, and that tree right there, and that bush. And, you know, what am I going to do when I get out in the real world? I'm going to roll around in the dirt. And so that's a really fundamental problem that zoos perpetuate, by the way, too, and that cities perpetuate, is this belief that that what is social is what's primary, but what's primary is the real physical world.
Without that, we don't have a place to stand. Well,
I have a great new line, which is, protect your land base. You can't have sex without it.
A good bumper sticker.
Yeah.
Well, recently a room full of college students, as you know, watched a classmate arrested and then tasered for asking John Kerry inconvenient questions. And what got me was the crowd just sat there without a murmur as though they were watching TV. Are you concerned the next generation will passively watch the destruction of nature, the end game?
The next generation? What about the current generation?
Well, I'm talking about young people here. I'm talking about college people.
I think the vast majority of people will never resist. And one of the things that really convinced me of that was Zygmunt Bauman's extraordinary book, Modernity and the Holocaust. And in there, he talks about one of the smartest things that the Nazis did was they made it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. So the question is, would you rather get an ID card, or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to move to a ghetto? Do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to get on a cattle car, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? Do you want to take a shower, or do you want to resist and possibly get killed? At every step of the way, it was in their rational best interest to not resist. And what Zygmunt Bauman says about that is that rational people go quietly, meekly into a gas chamber if only you allow them to believe it's a bathroom. And I would change that a little bit and say that rational people go quietly, meekly to the end of the world if only you allow them to believe that buying compact fluorescence is going to save the day. And so I think that most people are going to be won't resist, and most people will go to the end of the world, you know, just leave me alone and let me watch my television. And on the other hand, I think that there will be increasingly there will be people who join with the living planet as it becomes increasingly obvious this system is not working. And and there will be increasing numbers of people who do resist.
Well, I got to ask, I mean, what about the rest of us? You know, sometimes late at night after hearing news of stories of birds disappearing worldwide and the fish going away and the algae and the frogs and the bees, we get a sickening rage swelling up inside of us, and I know you've felt that. What can we do with our rage about human brutality to nature?
I think that I'm so glad that you asked the question, what can we do with it, as opposed to what can we do about it? Because so often, so many people think that rage is something to be avoided. But, you know, rage is just something to feel when there's something is outrageous. And just like despair is appropriate to feel in a desperate situation, and sorrow is appropriate to feel. We spend so much energy trying to avoid those bad feelings. But I just, for one thing, I just feel them. And then I use them to spur my action. I mean, years ago, this activist told me, I love this, it was about 10, 12 years ago now, and this one activist said to me that the only things that are keeping her going are rage and sorrow. And I don't really agree with that, because there's also love. But rage and sorrow certainly fuel my work, and love, and hate, and joy, and all those things. And so I think the thing, one of the reasons also that I think that we feel so frustrated is because so often we'll be presented with problems, and then the solutions that are presented to us are so obviously designed to simply be theater. And we know that in our bodies, and it creates this huge disjuncture. I mean, it's like you hear about how this, you know, some whole situation is so horrible, and then at the end you're told to write your representatives, you know, when we all know that the representatives serve the corporation. They don't serve us. They certainly don't serve the natural world. And that's a tremendous source of, I think, what's the word? That's a tremendous source of malaise. That's a source of burnout, because we keep doing the same things and they're not working. Well, instead of quitting, maybe we should try different things. And I can't say what those things are, except to say that we need to come up with options that are not constrained by those in power, because those in power are not going to allow anything to occur that in any way diminishes their power. And one of the most important things I think we can do is recognize that laws are made up by those in power to serve those in power. And I'm not saying that all laws are bad. I'm saying that we should pick and choose, and we should recognize that there's not a one-to-one correspondence between the legality of something and the morality of something. And that's not really any point that's new. I mean, Martin Luther King made the same point when he talked about how everything that was done in Nazi Germany was legal, and everything done on the Underground Railroad, I think he said, it might have been something else, everything done on the Underground Railroad was illegal. And I think we need to determine for ourselves what we think is right and what we think is wrong.
I'm speaking with Derek Jensen, a leading author in the deep ecology movement. Derek, I've read your two-volume book, Endgame, and I feel it should be required reading for college students.
Well,
it's part of a series of books that convinced me you are a legitimate philosopher in the old and deep meaning of that word. But for me and for many, you are sometimes a philosopher of last resort. I'm sure you've deconstructed our resistance to your message. What is it made of?
That's a good question. I've never gotten that one before. What is the resistance to my message made of?
Yes. Why do we people... we know you exist, or at least some people do. The media seems to kind of suppress your existence. Even those... you know, there's something about it. I read it, I want to agree, and yet I'm sort of holding off to the last minute my agreement. Why?
Well, because what I'm talking about, which is bringing down civilization, is pretty drastic. And, I mean, frankly, in a sense, it's a last resort for me, too. I mean, I didn't, I was going to say, I didn't, you know, spring full-blown from, you know, my mother's loins knowing this, but actually I probably did. You know, as an infant, as an animal, we all know it, and we get socialized out of it. But it took me a long time to get back here and to recognize that the system is not redeemable. And that's in some ways a bitter pill to swallow, and in some ways, I mean, it's to recognize that this experiment is not only atrocious and atrocity-inducing, but a miserable failure on every level, and it can't continue. This experiment called civilization, and of course, indigenous peoples worldwide agree, and you know, polar bears agree, and great auks agreed before they were exterminated, and so did passenger pigeons. But you know, it's a system that's not working, and there's a tremendous. It's really interesting that when you look at like an abusive family dynamic. It's very interesting. Everything is set up to protect the abuser. Everything. All their actions, all their inactions, they're all about protecting the abuser from the effects of his own behavior and from feeling the stuff that causes him to do this in the first place, him or her, but usually him. And it's similar with this culture that will do anything to avoid looking at the situation. And there's this great, in the 1960s, this guy Lester Laborsky did this experiment where he attached electrodes to people's eyeballs and he would track where they would look. He would show them photographs. And it was very interesting because what he found is that if a photograph contained something that the person found morally objectionable but that threatened their worldview, their eyes would never once even track to it, which means that they would see it out of the corners of their eyes and then they would not look there. And when they were asked later, was this thing in the photograph, they would say no and they'd be telling the truth because they didn't see it. And there's a story I remember reading about the head drug enforcement agency guy in Colombia. His wife was arrested for smuggling drugs in the United States. And one of the stories that both of them told was that she would do lines of cocaine in front of him, and he would walk through the room, and he wouldn't even see it. And, I mean, I know that I have in my life been in some relationships that are not very good, and, you know, all my friends go, you know, they tell me, they try to point out something, and I, you know, why are you trying to ruin my perfect relationship? And then when the relationship's over, it's like, oh my gosh, how did I not see that? You know, we're really good at avoiding looking at things. And another way to say this, Artie Lang came up with the three rules of a dysfunctional family, which are also three rules of a dysfunctional culture. And rule A is don't. And rule A1 is rule A does not exist. And rule A2 is never discuss the existence or non-existence rules A, A1, or A2. So we can talk forever about Britney Spears or Angelina Jolie or right. any of that, but we can't talk about the corporations that are killing the planet. We can't talk about the fact that 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. The oceans are effectively murdered. And we can't talk about that. We can't talk about the fact that the world's governments spend more money to subsidize commercial fishing fleets in the ocean than the actual value of the catch. So we would all be better off if the governments would just pay them the money to stay home. And we can't talk about any of that stuff. We can't talk about the fact that this culture is killing the planet. And so that's where that comes in, is that we're trained very, very early on to not talk about, to not look, oh, here's another one. I love this story. This was the central metaphor of my book, The Culture of Make-Believe, is the story of Ham and Noah. And the story of Ham and Noah is that Ham was one of Noah's sons, and Noah one night got drunk and passed out naked in his tent. And Ham went in and saw him and went out and told his brothers. And then his brothers would walk in backwards and so they wouldn't see their father's nakedness. And then they covered him with a garment. And the next day when Noah woke up, he was really mad at what Ham had done. And he cursed him forever, which is really convenient for white people because according to some stories, Ham was the ancestor of the Africans when it made it okay to enslave them. But be that as it may, I wondered when I read that story when I was a kid, I didn't understand it. It didn't make any sense to me at all. And only when I was writing that book did it suddenly make sense to me that it's the central cautionary tale of any oppressive system, which is if you see the patriarch, if you see the oppressor, those in power, if you see them naked, that is, as they are, and you talk about it, then you must be cursed because you've committed blasphemy. And that's the worst thing that one, from the perspective of the oppressor, one of the worst things you can do is to look at them as they are and to talk about them as they are. And so I think that that's part of the resistance, too. And it's weird because on one level there is some resistance, and on another level there's not. I mean, I was in Vancouver a while back, and the hall where we were was sold out at Langara. And I routinely, in the West especially, will have 400, 600, 700 people at a talk. So it's always been a little bit confusing for me because, on one hand, you know, I've got huge numbers of people go to talks oftentimes, and which is not always true. And like in New York City, I'll have like 30 people. It's very dependent on geography. But anyway, lots of people will come up, but there's essentially no media attention, and I can understand that.
Well, you know, if you'll give me a minute to explain, I have a criticism of your work as I perceive it that's kind of related to what you just described, and that is, I'm wondering if your vision needs to expand beyond the West Coast style of tree protection and cell phone towers and dams. I mean, you woke me up to the crazy number of destructive dams blocking nature all over. I thank you for that, and they must come down. But I propose we have even more urgent problems now, and forgive me if I've misread you or missed this, but would you agree to a sort of bastard adaptation of your work, something like this, that says, well, whatever we can do, whatever it takes, we'll stop three things. One, the coal trade, the mines, the trains, shut the coal power stations down, don't build any more. Two, no nuclear power. And three, don't make any more cars, shut down the auto industry, the planet can't take another single personal carbon machine. So, here are three rapid-fire questions about this
I wouldn't say that's accurate.
You wouldn't say that last one?
I wouldn't say any of those.
You wouldn't say any of those. Okay, well, now we're getting somewhere. Because I'm worried about the small window to save the climate and whether you're engaged with that or have you always been and I missed it. What's your reaction to what I've been saying here?
Well, what I want people to do is to think clearly about our predicament and to ask, if you want to achieve a certain thing, ask how you're going to go about doing it. And so if, for example, one of the examples I use in Endgame is if you care about salmon, what salmon need are six things, I think, to survive. They need for dams to be removed. They need for industrial logging to stop, industrial fishing to stop. They need for the oceans not to be murdered. They need for industrial agriculture to stop because of runoff. And they need for global warming to stop, which means they need the industrial economy to stop. And those are all straightforward technical tasks. That doesn't mean they're easy, it doesn't mean they're not daunting, but let's break it down. And so if you want global warming to not run away, what do you need to do? One of the things you need to do is you need to stop the industrial economy. And how do you do that? Well, okay, let's start asking those questions. And because the problem is not and has never been, how do we do this technically? The problem is wrapping our mind around the severity of the problem and doing something about it. And there can be a bazillion different things. I mean, I want to be really clear that although I'm calling for taking down the entire industrial economy, I think that there's one of the nice things about everything being so messed up is that no matter where you look, there's really good work to be done. So if what somebody is called to do is to work at a rape crisis hotline, that's great. Or if somebody wants to do rehabilitation work for a stream, that's great. Somebody wants to be an attorney, that's great. Somebody wants to learn explosives, that's great. It's like we need everything. And so that's the hesitation I have on focusing on cars or nuclear power or anything is that I think, because somebody could easily say, but gosh, I really love spotted owls. And you know, nuclear power doesn't really have anything right now to do with spotted owls. And so, you know, I don't want to dissuade that person from working to protect spotted owls. And I also want to back off on what I said. When I said the East Coast, I really did mean New York City itself. And, like, when I go to Michigan, it's a packed house. And when I go to North Carolina, it's a packed house. And so there is a geographical difference that I have a much bigger audience in the Northwest, but... But New York and D.C. actually are anomalies that are really small. So I don't think I need to change the message for the East. But anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's good enough. I'm wondering if there's anything else I've missed. Is there something else you'd like to tell our listeners?
Well, I think one of the important things to remember, and it's embarrassing even to have to say this, is that the only measure by which we're going to be judged by the people who come after is going to be the health of the land base. And they're not going to care about whether we wrote really good books, and they're not going to care about whether we did a really good radio show, and they're not going to care about whether we were vegetarians, they're not going to care about whether we drove, we recycled, whatever. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water. They're going to care about whether the land provides them with food. And when I was talking about the salmon or anything else, I want to come back to this very quickly, that global warming scares me very, very much. And it scares me more than almost anything. And so, yes, I think that we need to do whatever it takes to stop global warming. And the good news about global warming that I've heard is all the predictions that they make on, you know, how much the temperature is going to rise, those are all based on the continuation of the industrial economy. They don't take, for example, peak oil into account. I've asked people a bunch of times this question because I think it's a crucial question. They don't take peak oil into account. They don't take actually people stopping the industrial economy into account. And once again, that may sound like a pipe dream. You know, oh, yeah, stop the industrial economy, wink, wink. This guy's a lunatic. But the only thing I can think of that's even crazier than that is allowing this insane system to kill the planet. I mean, this is not a computer game where we get to go back and do it again. This is real life.
We've been speaking with Derek Jensen. You can tune into all his books and some of his new projects at derekjensen.org. Thanks for being so generous with your time and your work. For sure. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, and thanks for listening.
As you've heard, Derek really is a gentleman and a scholar. His arguments seemed way out there a few years ago, but get stronger every day we head further over the edge toward the end of nature. We need to shake up our minds, make up your own mind, and get active however you can. That's my opinion. This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.